Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Network. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
And glad you're with us this week. Later on in the program, the Army has a brand new strategy for how it'll operate and modernize its installations between now and 2035. Alex Beeler, the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Energy, Installations, and Environment, will join us to lay out the details. First up, though, the Navy Department is making some big changes to how it buys and uses commercial cloud computing services. Senior acquisition and IT leaders signed out a brand new cloud policy last month. Maybe the most notable change in the new policy is a more centralized approach to cloud. Within the next few months, all the Navy and Marine Corps' cloud purchases will be funneled through a single marketplace. Program managers won't be allowed to use their own contracts to buy cloud anymore. To talk about the new policy, we have two guests with us, both from the Navy's Program Executive Office for Digital and Enterprise Services, which will play a pivotal role in implementing the changes we're going to talk about. Travis Methvin is the Program Manager for the Naval Commercial Cloud Services Office, and Ruth Youngs Liu begins our conversation. She is the Program Executive Officer for PEO Digital.
Hey, Jared. Well, thank you very much for giving this opportunity to share our role with this new Dawn Cloud policy. So the Dawn Cloud policy was updated to provide for accelerated promotion, acquisition, and consumption of cloud services in the Dawn in direct support of the Dawn Information Superiority Vision and Dawn Cloud or DoD Cloud Strategy. To maintain our global strategic posture, the Dawn must leverage the inherent advantages of cloud technologies to modernize our enterprise IT infrastructure. So this cloud policy documents then where the Dawn is going with cloud as we go forward. So I think we're here to share more of the PEO role in this policy.
Yeah, you bet. And that's really where I wanted to focus too, since PEO Digital really does have such an integral role to the new policy. And let's just expand on that a little bit. For your organization, what's changing in terms of the way you provide cloud support services to the broader Dawn?
I think one of the big things that changes in how we're doing it is really in the spirit of how this policy has evolved is maturation of how we are as an organization driving to commercial cloud delivery. We approached it leveraging a very decentralized model in support of empowered CIOs looking for folks to kind of manage their portfolio and look at how they're deploying commercial cloud. And as we've evolved from that, what we've noticed is that, you know, that there's opportunities to align to a more centralized deployment model, exercising enterprise service managed delivery for things like INOX and things like security principles, as well as leveraging technology where commercial cloud companies have come up to speed in participation in the public sector arena. When we started this 2 years ago, a big driver was that commercial cloud companies weren't quite familiar with the DoD arenas and how to participate with DoDs, and that has evolved over the last 3 years.
Yeah, when we talk about centralization versus decentralization, it seems to me there's been a little bit of a pendulum swing on that in the Dawn. As you said, a couple years ago, there was a change to a more decentralized approach where all of the systems commands were allowed to be individual cloud brokers. Prior to that, then PEO EIS was kind of the centralized cloud broker. There was a cloud store talked about for a while prior to that decentralization. Are we going back to full centralization with one cloud store and one cloud broker, or is this something different?
I would say we never went away from what we refer to as our digital marketplace. That always became the enabling factor of a service managed organization explaining to mission owners how they get there. I think the change has really come as what we saw the cloud brokers evolving from trying to stand up business operation, create modernization opportunities, and start to build and deploy services. It just wasn't there. The budget wasn't there. The timing wasn't there for them to focus on their portfolio, modernization of their portfolios. And this is really part of the overall Dawn strategy of creating that centralization opportunities to focus on some of those key enablements. So I'm one piece in PMW 270 of a larger PEO digital strategy from a service managed organization. So you'll see in the cloud policy that it's referred to as the cloud service management office. Well, that is a piece of a larger enterprise services strategy that you'll see more from the Department of Navy in the future. This is acknowledgement of maturing over the last few years for the Department of Navy. I think that the leadership that we have in place in Department of Navy, Mr. Weiss, Ms. Rathbun, and those folks have really given us the opportunity to start driving and working in more in a modern service delivery model. And the cloud policy is a big piece of this, that you really start to see driving some of those efficiencies and some of that drive to get us to not only modern service delivery, but delivering and operating like industry.
That's interesting. So will other Navy organizations still retain authority to procure cloud services, or is the acquisition authority all being centralized in the PEO at this point?
So there's a little bit of a hybrid of model that's currently underway, but the intent is to decouple cloud services from other contracts that are in Department of Navy today. So one of the great lessons that we've learned was cloud was being wrapped up within development contracts and within system integration contracts. It really, it provided risk to the Department of Navy of understanding where our data was, where that security or how that security was being implemented. But it also gave us the opportunities to start focusing on other strategic initiatives when we start to think about the data strategy, our INOX framework, and how we're starting to deploy in more of an integrated fashion to support the mission of warfighters. And that includes things like Tactical Edge and our work with PEO C4I and work on the shipboard side as well.
Is part of it, too, getting rid of duplication situations where you might have five different contracts to buy AWS or Azure or, you know, one particular cloud service?
Oh, absolutely. I'd say the work that my counterpart, Chris Pratt, and team have done in PMW 290 to support DoD enterprise agreements, their ESI, ELAs, and CETAs is definitely a core principle of where we're trying to get to leverage that better buying power and to leverage that cost efficiency, if you will. But it also reduces the amount of time and effort it takes an organization to let their own contract if we can focus on enterprise availability of those things. It's also looking at how we support our partnership with DoD, the cloud offices within DoD, and their desire to get to enterprise environments. So the relationship and the partnership between PEO Digital, PMW 270, 290 is strong with how we're trying to drive towards that defense enterprise cloud environment.
Mr. Young-Saloom, let me go back to you, and I'm curious for your take on how you think this approach helps PEO Digital itself in its role as, you know, an IT systems acquirer and builder, because you're going to be consuming some of these same cloud services that you're in charge of providing. What does this do for you and all your PMWs?
So we are really making a shift within the PEO to be a more services organization. And while we definitely will be leveraging the services and do leverage the services within of what we're providing within our cloud service management organization, this is really the intent here is both for us internally, but for us to provide this service broadly to our naval organizations. So that, you know, all of the other PEOs, all of the other acquisition and, you know, just other general organizations across the Navy and Marine Corps will be able to leverage all of the services here.
And to the extent, probably back to Travis, to the extent there still are cloud contracts in other parts of the Don, is the intent to roll those into PEO Digital responsibility at some point, or just let them continue out through their period of performance? It's just that you guys are in charge of any new ones.
So the intent is to continue to allow them through their period of performance. The change comes in is leveraging the awareness of where that cloud is and how that cloud is being used to better align with that strategic priority. So if we start to look at things of how we promote those enterprise IT services, we have to be cognizant that there's going to be opportunities as those contracts come end of life, that things like identity management and zero trust principles are going to start to be implemented as those contracts come to the end.
What's the status of the marketplace as of now? You said that's you know, kind of existed for a couple of years now. In what ways is it changing? What sorts of products are in it today? What do you envision adding to it?
So today, currently, it's a cost evaluation, a service delivery framework, I don't want to call it a clearinghouse, but it's really the starting resource for a mission owner. Over the next, I would say, 4 to 6 months, you're going to start to see the ability to use API-driven self-service deployments, things like infrastructure as code for our agreements with Azure and IL2, 4, and 5. You'll start to see software as a service with our partnership with ServiceNow through an automated deployment. And looking at those opportunities to continue industry partnerships of how do we get those automated scripted deployments that allow mission owners to start to work a little bit more efficiently and get to those deployments in what used to take 9 to 12 months for individual applications. We're really trying to reduce a barrier and get it into, you know, in a week's time with inheritance and driving to reciprocity and how we're working with other organizations.
And how about maybe talk a little bit about the consumption monitoring function of this whole marketplace? Because, I mean, that's a clear benefit of a little bit more centralization if you guys are able to watch everything. How fleshed out is that? How's that going to work?
So it is definitely in development. There is a consumption monitoring, and we're working towards the CMDB in support of Department of Navy. Initially, we are focusing on, like I said, our Azure deployments so that we can start to evaluate, one, where cloud spend is going and how that cloud spend is happening. But again, this starts to help us identify that demand signal and where we can start to look to find those greater efficiencies working with the digital organization. But initially, it is primarily focused on our infrastructure as code with the Azure deployments.
Travis Methvin is the project manager for the Naval Commercial Cloud Services Office. Also talking with Ruth Youngs-Liu, the Navy's Program Executive Officer for Digital and Enterprise Services. They're back with us after a quick break as we talk more about the Navy's new commercial cloud computing policy. This is on DoD on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. I'm Jared Servin. Back on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is on DoD. I'm Jared Serbu, and we're talking with Travis Methvin, the project manager for the Naval Commercial Cloud Services Office, and Ruth Youngs-Liu, the Navy's Program Executive Officer for Digital and Enterprise Services, about the Navy's new commercial cloud policy. As we've been discussing, one major feature of that policy is it'll route all of the Navy and Marine Corps' cloud purchases through a single marketplace run by PEO Digital. Notionally, how does this process work? I mean, let's say I'm a mission owner building some new ERP somewhere in the Navy. I'm no longer allowed to buy my own cloud services as part of that contract, so I've got to go to PEO Digital. How does that whole transaction play out?
So it starts with the mission owner going to https://cloud.navy.mil. It's CAC-enabled. It allows the mission owner to get in there and start that journey and understanding where those services are. You use something like SAP or ERP services, excuse me, which is an interesting use case because it talks about where we're starting to bridge this centralization to the model of working with our cloud brokers today. So NAVAIR primarily hosts our ERP and supports that activity with cloud deployments. So this really starts them on a journey of where those services are, what that would cost to do things of hosting, create that or the costs associated, helps them with that ROM planning, if you will. But it also creates that connecting opportunity in those cases to work with commercial cloud with Navy cloud brokers who are providing certain services today. If you wanted to talk about the infrastructure as a code, this primarily focuses on how those mission owners can get to scripted deployments of how we looked at where those services would be deployed for applications such as, you know, three-tiered web applications that are very scripted and deployed to get them into a sandboxed environment. And it starts a workflow that we start to get the awareness of how the funding is, where that funding's coming from, what the usage and demand, and where those authorizing folks within their organization allow them to have awareness of where those commercial cloud deployments are.
You've mentioned infrastructure as code a couple times. Can you just briefly give us give our listeners a description of what infrastructure as a code means as the Navy understands it, and how mature your capability is, you think, to deploy something like or realize a concept like infrastructure as code?
So infrastructure as code primarily is a scripted deployment that allows capacity from a commercial cloud to have the attributes and security requirements built into those deployment models. The big big key attribute that we added in was we call it more of an infrastructure as code plus, because one of the things that we looked at was making sure that we could support the IPs, security, identity challenges that many mission owners are going to face. And this helped us stay aligned with where we are going with some of our identity activities. I would say where we are in the maturity element for an infrastructure as code deployment is, I would say we're definitely in the walk phase. It's something that is going to grow and mature as not only Department of Navy becomes more familiar, but also as DOD and larger strategic initiatives, things like Zero Trust and how those principles come in. This is going to be the model of how we scale and how we scale it with that compliancy and with that availability of information that allows us to get there. Because we can't keep going touch labor to get to how we you know, and I just had this interesting conversation about ITIL principles of how we, you know, traditionally do cloud deployments or infrastructure deployments is it's very ticketed oriented. It's very team oriented where we hand off. And what we're really trying to do is consolidate that. And I see that growing more and more as we start to align to greater enterprise availability of services, not only through digital, but also, like I said, through DOD.
So if we start to think about cloud assets as one controllable infrastructure, is that difficult when you're working with multiple different cloud providers or consuming services from multiple different cloud providers?
I don't think it becomes difficult. I think it's the variations that we've implemented in the Navy over the past decade of how we've created that convoluted deployment methodology. I think when you start to look at commercial cloud from the availability of services and how those services are deployed, it's really something that we could start to reduce that variation to help other things that we didn't know at the time were probably not industry best practices for how we were doing a very decentralized IT deployment. I think it helps clean up some of that mess. It helps, and even in a multi-cloud environment, it still gives us that opportunity as long as we focus on the core services that we're looking at, identity being obviously a huge one, and helping mission owners get to those things. We have to get out of the duplication of where we traditionally were doing managed service offerings or applications were bringing those services on their own.
And does that also get to another aspect of the memo, which calls on PEO Digital to work with Fleet Cybercom to build a command and control structure for all the cloud assets? Is that something that would also require you to have one coherent, cohesive view into all your cloud assets?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things is focusing on, you know, MVP deployments and how we are targeting support for Fleet Cyber's INOC delivery. The big thing was focusing on how we could get them availability and awareness of where Navy workload or Department of Navy workloads were. And that focus and that drive really drives us to tenancy models, and it supports other things like we're doing with 365 and where we're doing other cloud adjacent things, but this really helps drive to support those strategic initiatives like the command and control and INOC principles.
Also on the security piece, the memo talks about reciprocity as well, which is probably going to be pretty important considering I think you're going to have a lot of availability for cloud contracts that are not Navy contracts in the marketplace, right?
Absolutely. Currently on our digital marketplace today, we have strong partnerships with not only DISA, but also the Air Force and Army cloud hosting environments or Cloud One. We work with Platform One, looking at the reciprocity, supporting that. The benefit that I've seen or I've been able to experience over the past few months is our unification efforts with the Marine Corps. A strong relationship with Ken Bible and the team, General Malock and the team, has really provided us some great opportunities to really express some of that reciprocity, even in that blue and supportive green, where we talk about the Dawn specifically.
What have you seen from that? Is it mostly time savings? And can you give us a sense of what kind of benefits you've seen out of that particular reciprocity example?
I think Ruth probably has some real-time examples of what we're seeing with the RDAS program and what we're seeing with some of the pipeline support it's not only a time savings, but it also there's a development savings as well when we don't have to continue to develop over and over and over, repeat the work when we know it's something that's going to have to traverse back to a Navy platform. But and that's where really where we're seeing not only a time savings, but also a cost and a development savings.
Right. And just to build on the Ardaeus example, that's one particular program within another PEO, but they are absolutely leveraging the McBoss pipeline to get speed to, you know, get the, through the development process much faster. And so they did a complete analysis, walked through what the different options were, and then chose that path, which is the first of where we're actually taking a Navy program then and putting it through through the Marine Corps pipeline there.
This is kind of a side question, Travis, but there's a explicit exemption in the memo for cloud services that are not going to receive, process, store, or display DoD information. I'm having trouble thinking of what an example of that would be and why you would be buying cloud services that aren't going to contain DoD information.
So one of the things that we've grown to understand is the distinction between subscription-based services and software as a service. And so that's really was our attempt at having that conversation of things that would be subscription that are not housing Navy data that may not necessarily need to flow through a commercial cloud office or have that restriction placed upon it.
Huh. I guess I still don't get it. Like what would that software as a service offering be? I mean, it would, if it's not processing or storing DoD data, why is DoD buying it or why is the Navy buying it?
So some of the examples that we've seen to date are like resume search engines that allow folks to give us that subscription-based information that we're not housing specific data on there, but we're receiving their services. So it's subscription-based services versus software as a service, and that's why we built that in.
Travis Methvin is the project manager for the Naval Commercial Cloud Services Office, and we were also joined by Ruth Youngs-Liu, the Navy's Program Executive Officer for Digital and Enterprise Services, to talk about the Navy's brand new cloud policy. We'll post a link to the policy itself at federalnewsnetwork.com/ondod. Another short break, and when we come back, the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Energy, Installations, and Environment joins us to talk about that service's new installation strategy. That's next on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Servin.
What's best for you and your federal career? And what comes next? Your turn with Mike Causey. Search Your Turn.
Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. The Army is rethinking a lot of old notions. It's already launched a people strategy that puts a new and larger emphasis on soldier work-life balance. Now the Army's out with an installation strategy. That plan also upends previous Army thinking about bases and facilities. Alex Beeler is the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. He talked about the new plan with Federal News Network's Scott Massioni.
Earlier, in the last couple years, the leaders in their effort to transform the Army set out top priorities that included people, modernization, and readiness. And in that regard, the Army senior leaders had previously supported and approved Army strategies for modernization and people. And as Chief McConville has written relatively recently, and I'm quoting here, installations must be in a position to allow the Army to do its job. As we transform the Army, we have to transform installations along with it. That, in a nutshell, is why we need at this time and why the Army senior leaders approve an Army installation strategy.
How does this fit in with the Army's goals as a whole?
The whole role of installations are and have become strategic readiness platforms for training, mobilization, and deployment. Thus, they are critical warfighting enablers of the Army. the installation strategy recognizes this important fact and thus helps the Army leaders to embrace a change narrative from that of something that in the past had been relatively static and removed, if you will, from the thrust of the Army going into any kind of fight, or into a new cultural norm with installations, if you will, at the starting gate, where every mission starts and is sustained.
And how is this different from past installation plans that you've used?
First and foremost, it's the first Army enterprise-wide strategy that identifies need for modernized, resilient, and sustainable installations. How best, basically, to move forward to support what we call the multi-domain ready force for the next 15-plus years. Given this recognized enhanced role, then how Army installations execute services and systems can best be protected from adverse adversarial attacks and climate change and environmental degradation. So that is the significance. That is how things differ from anything else the Army has attempted in this past. Past plans were really pretty much within the installation's energy and environment, if you will, portfolio and scope. This strategy not only has the support and approval of the three Army senior leaders, but also all of the generals of the landed commands. We received over comments from over 150 different Army leaders throughout the enterprise. So this really is a concerted effort that was deliberately done to draw in everybody of significance within the Army. And therefore, we're very hopeful that this really will jumpstart a cultural sea change into how all levels of the Army look at the role of the installations. And finally, in response, I should say that the strategy is definitely in sync with the earlier strategies that I mentioned of modernization and people. In fact, the people strategy that was approved and signed off in 2019 certainly was an inspiration for our office and a very effective guide on how to put forth the Army installation strategy and get buy-in and approval across the enterprise.
So there's three things that really stood out to me in this strategy. One is that there's a focus on technology. Two is that there's a huge focus on people. And then the third is that there's a focus on how the homeland is no longer a safe sanctuary for the Defense Department and for the Army. So, you know, if you could just talk a little bit to each of those, and especially that last one there.
You've alluded to the National Defense Strategy comment of a couple years ago that the homeland is no longer a sanctuary for the United States. And so with that mantra in mind, we view the Army installation strategy, and this is from the strategy, which is the fence line is now the front line. And so what that means to us from an installation standpoint is, on the one hand, installations are now more vital than ever to mission success. As I mentioned earlier, it's where we train, mobilize, and deploy. it's in effect where we are the starting gate and we are the sustaining function of missions that are carried out. So we're more engaged, if you will, from a positive standpoint in mission success and therefore the Army's success. And conversely, we are more exposed to a whole host of threats, and I guess you could put them in two broad categories. One is what we like to describe as near-peer power threats, and that could be whether it's from China or Russia or any other potential adversary. That would include things like cybersecurity threats. And then the second is more from a natural standpoint, climate change, which once again is specifically mentioned in the strategy. That's a very important component of what we want the installations to be focused on. And also, of course, always environmental degradation.
Alex Beeler is the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. More of his conversation with Scott Massioni about the Army's new installation strategy after one more break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. I'm Jared Servian.
Wisdom served daily. Experience the difference of the journalists at Federal News Network.
Back on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network, I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. As we return to our conversation with Alex Beeler, the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment, he talked about the Army's new strategy for installations through 2035 with Federal News Network's Scott Massioni.
Over the past 2 years, the Army has been dealing with issues within privatized military housing. The main issue has been that there has been mold, lead paint, mice, and other problems within these households, and families feel like they can't find their voice or they can't be heard from the leaders of the service when they do have issues. How does this plan take into account the individual soldiers, their families, and their importance, especially when you're looking at the Army's people strategy, which tries to add a little bit more credence to what soldiers think and what they need throughout a career? So what does this plan do to really address their concerns?
Our most valuable asset are people. It's not equipment or weaponry. And I think that is perhaps, that starts with the sea change. And that certainly is very much reflected and pronounced in the people strategy. And then that the implementing plans that have, we like to say, been cascading down from the people strategy over the past year. Likewise, the installation strategy provides a holistic approach on investment and use of all of the facilities on any given base, with the idea that the number one focus of investment and of management starts with the people on the base. I think that is a sea change, a cultural change that I think will then permeate through in the areas such as housing, so that the customer are the people and not providing things detached from that. So that technology innovation, we've really pushed things like the work order app. That's just one example, so that when things are not right in a resident's home, they're tied into the app, they can report it immediately and it gets registered and responded to. And things, of course, involving life, health, and safety get our top priority in that regard. There is the staffing that has been greatly increased, both by the private companies involving in their housing management, as well as the overseeing Army housing offices, to make sure that complaints are handled that in a timely and effective fashion, that residents understand who they can call to get support or who they can communicate with, to understand their roles and responsibilities, as well as their, if you will, Bill of Rights, a greater emphasis on inspection, on to the extent that we're going to be building new housing or significantly renovating new housing, that it is built toward quality, not just to code. And all of that, as I say, goes back to the focus on people, the soldiers, and the family, because we know if the soldier is worried about, you know, the housing or some aspect of the family or child care, that is a distraction that is really unnecessary, that should be corrected so that the soldier can focus as much as possible on the mission facing that soldier.
What's the role of technology when it comes to this installation plan? You mention in the strategy things like smart cities, smart grids, all those sorts of interesting and exciting new 21st century types of innovations. What is the plan for those, and how might they be integrated within military bases?
Hopefully very smoothly, at least from an outlook standpoint. Of course, the devils are in the details. The use of technology may vary tremendously from installation to installation, depending on what that installation's mission capabilities might be. However, there certainly is going to be a fundamental need, and we're certainly going to push for the type of technical innovation that I'll say is non-tactical related. In other words, sort of basic commercial stuff. One example are autonomous vehicles that are self-driving. There's an example that was an experiment that was tried for several months successfully at in our general neighborhood here, Fort Myer Henderson Hall, where, as I say, vehicles could shuttle people around without the added expense of individual drivers. Plus, they would be able to keep on a very well-defined and well-publicized schedule. Currently, there's another one being tried out at Fort Carson. You have an operational tool that is currently being employed by Fort Benning, who, by the way, prides themselves on attempting to lead as the installation of the future, trying to incorporate things now as best as possible. And, of course, we welcome that. An installation operations tool basically helps with figuring out where maintenance or replacement of critical assets, physical facility assets, might be needed in advance of them failing, so that you could do appropriate preventive maintenance or replacement accordingly. But we want to promote the use of smart city models as much as possible. As you can imagine, many of our larger bases, installations, starting with Fort Bragg, which is the largest, are really cities unto themselves. And then you add the surrounding communities that sort of magnify the nature of, I'll call this, metropolis. And so the more that we can effectively engage in those large areas of populations with the surrounding community in smart technologies, using, you know, whether it's sensors or biokinetic processes for instance, for access entry points in and out of the installations, the more effective we're going to be. We also have access to wonderful program of ESTCP and CERTIP. These are programs that are run out of the Office of Secretary of Defense, but they are geared to do some basic R&D as well as testbed certification out at installations to try new technologies that are addressing a concern that the one or more of the services might have. And there's a technical working committee where each of the services is represented and can supply, shall we say, statement of needs that the OSD folks at ESTCP and CERTIP will incorporate or will select. And that is a great way of getting technology from the private sector applied and to see how effective it is. And of course, if it's shown to be effective, then the military and of course the Army in the lead can be one of the major commercial customers of that new technology.
Alex Beeler is the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. He talked with my colleague, Scott Massioni, about the Army's new installations strategy. More details on that plan and the document itself are at federalnewsnetwork.com. Earlier in the hour, we talked with leaders at the Navy's Program Executive Office for Digital and Enterprise Services about the Navy's brand new cloud computing policy. If you missed that conversation, we'll post this week's full program, as always, at federalnewsnetwork.com/ondod. Also, find us in podcast form. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, including Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. That's it for this week's edition of On DoD. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. I'm Jared Servia. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD on Federal News Network. Tune in Wednesday mornings at 11 or subscribe to this show on iTunes or Podcast One.